We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Adrian Day, CEO of Adrian Day Asset Management and manager of Euro Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, thanks for joining me again.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom. I always enjoy your interviews.
Thank you. When people like yourself say that they watch even half my shows, it always kind of makes me pinch myself because, you know, being a source for many different opinions in the space and having a lot of contradictory or seemingly contradictory opinions in the space is something that's important. So, you know, having it be a source for those in the industry, I think is important and interesting as well.
And, you know, the other thing is it may not be contradictory, but people look at markets different ways. They come from different angles, and that's always helpful.
Absolutely. So, Adrian, I wanted to start today a little bit differently. You know, usually I kind of start with the macro things and then zoom into why that affects gold, how that affects gold. But I'd like to start a little bit differently today because there's not many people that know, you know, a heck of a lot more about the actual, let's say, nuts and bolts of investing in the gold industry, as it were, the actual miners. So I'd like to talk about the business of actually mining gold. When we see miners missed targets, like for example, Barrick did recently at the end of Q1. Should that warrant more of an investigation into what the circumstances were surrounding what happened, rather than investors just being disappointed in the company and writing it off? And, you know, obviously, just as a caveat, this conversation isn't meant to recommend for or against buying Barrick. It's just to use them to illustrate this example of what we're talking about.
Sure. Now, that's a good point. And yeah, so people, if we talk about a particular stock, people, even in a moderately complimentary way, people shouldn't assume I'm saying it's a good buy, and certainly not necessarily a good buy now. But maybe it's also worth disclosing while we're on all this stuff that if I do sound very enthusiastic about something, then assume that we own it for clients and we own it personally. No, that's a good question, and I'll use Barrick, but step back a little bit. You know, there's certain companies, you talk about misses, there's certain companies that tend to give aggressive or optimistic estimates and guidance, and there are other companies that tend to give more conservative or cautious guidance. Now, when I asked Amar from the CEO of Agnico, that he said, no, we're not conservative. We're just realistic. Well, okay. And you'd probably say, ask Mark Bristow at Barrick the same question. And in fact, I have asked him the same question. No, we're not optimistic. We're just realistic. But I think different personalities would have a different assessment. And I think it's true to say that Barrick is one of those companies where the guidance has tended to be optimistic. Bristow's a very, very positive, optimistic kind of person. That sets you up, however, for misses. Now, if you look at Barrick, they have had, I think it's fair to say, they've had several production misses in the last few years. And when you miss on production, then, of course, your per ounce costs go up. If you mine low, fewer ounces than you expected, your per ounce costs go up. So people look at production down and then they say to me, oh, not only was production down, but their costs went up as well. Well, the two are kind of two sides of the same coin. I think in the case, if we look at, to answer your question specifically on Barrick in the last quarter, the first quarter of 24, you know, they have given production guidance, they came out with their production numbers and their guidance on costs in January. They were down, the production was down, the stock collapsed. Then they came out last week with their financials, which actually didn't have any more bad news than was already in the initial release. But the stock went down again. And I think there's people who are, Barrick is certainly one of those companies, and I think also Pan American to some extent is one of those companies, where after you've had misses for a certain number of years or quarters and years, people are just waiting for the bad news. They're looking for the bad news to press the button and say, Barrick failed again. As I say, when you look at their financials last week, I don't think you could honestly say that there was anything in those financials that should not have been expected by someone who looked at their annual guidance and looked at the production numbers that they came out with in January. You know, but the stock went down. The other thing I'd say about Barrick is, and this has been true for several years, and Mark Bristow has telegraphed it very, very well and repeatedly to the market. The first quarter is always a bad quarter for them, and the fourth quarter is normally their best quarter. And so, yeah, I was not concerned about this quarter's numbers, to be honest with you. And in fact, when you see the stock react the way it did, especially to the financials, which should have already been in the market, you know, I take that as an opportunity to buy, quite honestly.
Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, Adrian, you know, let's say the per ounce cost of mining, or you know, we can also take the AISC or the all-in sustaining cost. Which metric do you think best captures what you want to see out of them?
Well, on costs, I think you want to look at both. And I always call them the so-called all-in sustaining costs. But at least it's a metric that's the same across the board. I think you want to look at both because you obviously want you want low per ounce operating costs. But the all-in sustaining costs is obviously an important metric, particularly if you're comparing one company to the other. Any large company, whether it's Barrick, Newmont, Agnico, Pan American, with multiple mines in multiple jurisdictions, there is always going to be a problem. At every quarter, is going to have some problem somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of mining. Murphy's Law. Well, Robert Friedman likes to say that Murphy works overtime in the mining business. You know, I mean, things will go wrong and you can't get away from that. The important thing is how many things go wrong and how does the company fix those problems? So, you know, Barrick's had a couple of major things in the last 12 years. They had the equipment they got for the expansion of Pueblo Viejo, which is one of their largest mines, didn't work properly. So that delayed. They had to get the equipment manufacturers out. That's delayed the expansion that they were expecting at the end of last year. It's not in the first quarter, but all expectations are that we will see that production ramp up throughout the year, and the fourth quarter should be good. Then Nevada mines, some of them are struggling. Certainly, it looks as though they've matured. Well, they are mature mines, but most of them, it looks like, you know, that's declining. They had the hit in Mali, of course, where there was a report that the Mali military government, I guess we call them junta to make them sound more evil than maybe they are. The military junta was going to expropriate their mine in Mali, which is, oh gosh, that's about 8 to 10% of their NAV, so significant. So that there were several sort of things that hit the company, you know, all at the same time. The issue is how do you deal with it? And I think they're dealing with all three of those in the best way that they possibly can.
You know, you mentioned these, let's say, unplanned versus planned causes of production misses. How do we really separate these? And you know, does it come right back to this idea of what you just mentioned about how they deal with these issues when they do come up?
Right. Well, it's known. It's been known for a few years now. And again, Bristow has made it clear to the market that, you know, you're going to get lower production out of many of the larger mines in Nevada. So that's not a surprise. That's just a geological thing. You know, I think in Pueblo Viejo, it's just one of those things that happens. And it's happened to many, many companies. Fortuna, if you remember, when they were building Lindero in Argentina, they had equipment that didn't work properly or wasn't set up properly, and they had to bring the manufacturers out. So those sort of hiccups, either at the beginning of a mine or an expansion, are frankly not completely unexpected, not always, or not often in these two cases, not the company's fault at all. You know, in Mali and in geopolitical circumstances generally, Bristow has shown himself, this isn't an advertisement for Mark Bristow, by the way, Bristow has shown himself to be very, very proactive, very, very dynamic, and very capable at working with various governments, you know, to get mines, to maintain mine production, to get mines back on stream. So with Mali, you know, he went out to Mali, they have negotiations with the government, they have in writing from the government, for what it's worth, they have in writing from the government, there's no intention of closing the mine. So they're in discussions about what is an equitable division of the profits. And I think the military junta has no particular desire to try and operate a mine. And Bristow has been successful. You saw him fix the problems they had in Tanzania, where the Tanzania mines were shut down. They spun off the Tanzania mines, if you remember, years ago, because of difficulties we don't need to get into now. The Tanzania government shut them down. Bristow acquired the Tanzania assets back again from the company that they'd spun off, and he flew out and managed to get it back up. These things are never quick, mm-hmm. and they do take some kind of concessions, but it takes a certain style, personality, if you like, to be able to work with government. See what he did in Papua New Guinea, where the mine was shut down for years, and he got a lot of different interests. You know, landowners, plantation owners, you know, local government, central government, local people. He got a lot of different interests together and eventually he got the mine back up. So that's another mine that they were hoping would contribute last year. Didn't really contribute very much at all, but this year it'll ramp up and should be a big contributor. And you know, that's a special skill. Bristow came from Randgold. As you'll remember, and Randgold was an entirely Africa-focused mining company, and he's South African himself, so he has experience and skill at working with different governments, military coups, civil wars, you know, etc. To keep the mines running, to keep the people safe, and so forth. But I think people were not wrong to look at a newspaper story that the Mali government is considering expropriating the mine. They weren't wrong to look at that and sell the stock down. Ordinary investors weren't wrong to do that, of course. But if you knew a little bit more and you'd followed that story, you'd see there was really nothing new in that news report. And so the next step is, okay, company, Dr. Bristow, what's the real story here? And, you know, I wouldn't say we can discount it 100%, but I think we can certainly, I feel a lot more comfort. You know, when you look at one last thing on this, if I may, when you look at a company like Barrick, everybody knows that Barrick has, you know, a pretty high risk political profile. Say, particularly if you compare them with, say, Agnico, the number three miner in the world, the political risk is night and day. Barrick trades at lower multiples than does Agnico. A part of that is because of Agnico's political risk premium and Barrick's political risk discount. Mm-hmm. Part of it is fully justified. But when you operate in countries like Mali and Congo and Zambia and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan,
Dominican Republic.
Well, Dominican Republic, of course, is one of the more politically stable countries in their stable. But in those sort of countries, jurisdictions, you are going to have problems from time to time, and more importantly, you're going to have headlines from time to time. And really, it's an issue. It's a matter of how do you deal with it.
But I mean, I feel like you could. At different points in time, you could look at that as a positive for the company as well. You know, when you're splitting your political risk through so many of these different exposures, one would think that, you know, depending on how you look at it, that would be a positive at some different times.
Well, this is what I joke. I say, yeah, every single country they operate in, nearly every country they operate in is awful, but they've diversified. They've got diversified political risk. That's for sure.
Which I think in their case, I think that can be a positive because of that, you know, that level, let's say, of diversity. If you have, let's say, 10 different jurisdictions that you're operating within instead of just three.
And also, if you look at them, sorry, go on.
I was going to say,
if you look at the mines, like the Reko Diq copper mine in Pakistan, I mean, the plain fact is, you wouldn't get a mine like that that could easily be running for 100 years. You know, where else will you find that except in high-risk jurisdictions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to be able to have so many of those different types of mines as well with different
maturities,
life
or whatever,
cycles,
yeah,
different maturities is interesting as well.
No, absolutely. And that's not to, you know, if you look at, again, the opposite of that would be a company like Agnico, but has deliberately and specifically and as a highest priority focused on safe political jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So they're in Ontario and Nunavut in Canada. They're in Australia. They're in Finland. And they're in Mexico. You know, all of those countries, even Mexico, are among the top mining jurisdictions in the world. But again, even when you're in safe jurisdictions, you can have problems. Mexico, we know about the open pit mining ban and the permitting issues down there. In Finland, they had to reduce their production for a while because apparently they were making too much noise. No, that was Australia, sorry. In Fosterville, they had to reduce their production because they were making too much noise. In Finland, they had a problem, but they couldn't, you know, expand properly. So even it's all of those issues have been resolved now, by the way. But I'm saying even in safe jurisdictions, you do have problems.
You know, Adrian, when you're analyzing any of these companies and you're trying to consider when is a good time to buy them? A lot of these bigger companies have polymetallic deposits or projects that hold or host different metals and minerals. So how do you try to understand or value a company like that? You know, with copper and gold, for example, just below all-time highs, does that tend to skew a proper analysis at different times in the cycle?
No, I'm not sure it does. I mean, I think the bigger issue will be, let's say, a company like Fortuna, and Fortuna's releasing their results probably as we speak, and because of my internet problems, I haven't seen them yet. But the bigger issue is a company, let's say, like Fortuna, that has gold and silver, but a lot of their silver comes from, let's say, their mine in Peru, Caylloma, which is primarily a zinc mine. Zinc, lead, and silver is a minority of their production. And so, therefore, you have to look at zinc as well as a contributor to the overall company, even though that's not why you're buying it, right? You're buying it for the gold and silver. You're not buying it because they produce zinc. But at different times, depending on the mine sequencing, the zinc can be a majority of a production from that particular mine. Mm-hmm. But I think you just have to, if you know the company, you just have to look at the company, look at what percentage of their revenue comes from the different metals, and just factor that in. I don't think there's any particular magic to that.
Mm-hmm. So, Adrian, before we hit record today, we were kind of discussing this disconnect between the gold price and the gold miners or the metal miners. When do you think, or how do you think that disconnect starts to close?
Good question. And, we all know why gold has done well. Gold has done well for the last 18 months. Gold has done well primarily because of central banks, and then more recently because of Chinese savers who want to put their money somewhere safe when they're worried about the economy. They're worried about a yuan devaluation. They're worried about perhaps stimulus coming in. So where do you put the money? They don't want to put them in stocks that are depressed. They don't want to put them in real estate, which is where they would traditionally put them. They can't put them in crypto. They're not allowed to. So gold is the obvious place to look at it. And for both of those buyers, the central banks that are worried about dollar weaponization, and I'm simplifying here, of course, and the Chinese savers that just want to put their money somewhere where it's not going to evaporate, they tend to be less price sensitive than, let's say, you or I, if we are looking for making some money on gold. So they're less price sensitive, and gold moved up, as we know, even in the face of a macroeconomic environment, aggressive rate hikes, high interest rates, and a strong dollar, that should, in fact, and a reasonably strong economy, apparently, but should be negative for gold. So at the end of last year, you could, I think, legitimately ask the question, is gold, this will sound like a sacrilege, but is, in fact, gold the one that's overpriced and the gold stocks are appropriately priced for the economic environment? Now, things have changed a bit this quarter. They've changed because, obviously, with the high price of gold, despite oil price going up, the margins have expanded tremendously. So companies, and we saw this, we've seen this with several of the companies that have already reported, earnings and cash flow, anyway, cash flow and free cash flow should be pretty strong this quarter. And if a company's not making good cash flow, you have to ask why. There's a real problem. So that's just to sort of set the scene. So I don't think, up until recently, I don't think there was anything particularly mysterious about the fact that people, investors, were not buying gold stocks because the macro environment was negative for gold and the broad stock market was doing well. I think what will change that is basically three things. One is gold staying up over 2,000, over 2,100, staying up for a period. That's the first thing. The second thing that will change it is the Federal Reserve and other central banks starting to become more accommodative, particularly if they cut interest rates. And then the third thing that will change it is the broad market stumbling. I don't mean crashing, but just the leaders for the last two or three years, stumbling. And we're beginning to see all of those things happen. We're beginning to see some rotation in the broad market. When you look at, Apple, of course, was up after their earnings, but Apple and Tesla, they've certainly had very bad starts to the year. So not all the Magnificent Seven are quite as magnificent this year as they were last year. I think when you start to see the S&P, particularly the leaders, start to sort of roll over a little bit, people will look for rotation. Mm-hmm. And there'll be lots of places, you know, value stocks, small cap, emerging markets. There's lots of places that have lagged. But one of the areas that has lagged and are still cheap are commodity stocks generally, and then particularly the gold stocks. I mean, when to me, this is just an incredible opportunity for investors that we normally don't get. You've got the opportunity now where the gold price is very strong, and notwithstanding the possibility of a $100 or $200 decline in the next sort of 2 or 3 months, over the course of 6 months and 12 months and 18 months, the gold price is likely to stay high because of the factors driving the gold price. And yet the gold stocks are just flat on their back. And you don't often get that opportunity. Normally, when the gold stocks are this cheap, you actually don't want to be buying them. And when the gold price has moved up the way it's moved up, the gold stocks are ridiculously overpriced. We are in a very fortunate position now where we can buy gold stocks when they're still very, very undervalued.
Mm-hmm. So on the other side of that, though, Adrian, what could go wrong, right? Like, we can close that gap one of two ways, by gold stocks going up or by gold going down. So what could go wrong for the gold price that would bring it back down, maybe even below $2,000?
Sure. You know, again, I've said a couple of times, one of the problems when you're relying on, let's say, central banks to drive the price of gold, as we were for all of last year, the big problem is that you're relying on a very few people to make positive buy decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, when everybody's lined up at coin stores buying coins or buying ETFs, you've got millions of people, and you need millions of people to change your mind. In the case of a central banks, you're really looking at five or six central. I mean, different central banks have been buying this month, and then 2 months later, and 6 months later. But most of the buying that we've seen in the last 18 months has come from China and literally four or five other central banks. So if those central banks decided, for whatever reason, that's five people, if five people decided for whatever reason just to hold off buying more, and it could just be a macro decision, it could just be, well, let's give it a pause, we've got enough for now, that would have a significant impact on the price of gold. So that's number one. China, I don't think China is going to allow their citizens to buy crypto. I don't think the sentiment inside China is going to change dramatically towards the need for some secure place for savings. I don't think Chinese people are going to become real estate investors again in a significant way very soon, but maybe more money will go into the stocks, which are so beaten up, so cheap, and maybe some of the money will go into the stocks. And you know, the macro environment just continues to be negative towards gold. You know, we've already had the Federal Reserve primarily, but also a couple of other central banks, you know, push back against the idea that they're going to ease aggressively anytime soon. Some Fed spokesmen are talking about maybe no cuts this year. Some are even talking about hikes. I don't think we'll get hikes, but so, I mean, if we see the macro environment for gold continue to be negative for longer, you know, you get a combination of those things, and you could easily see gold come down. The good thing about the gold stocks is, I mean, we've had this rally since the end of February, you know, 30% or whatever in the XAU. So if gold were to go under 2,000, you could erase that. But I don't think there's an awful lot more downside in the gold stocks. Mm-hmm. Again, you look at Agnico. If you look at Agnico's price to free cash flow, it is the lowest multiple other than the last quarter of 2015. It's the lowest multiple in 40 years. So I don't think a quality company like Agnico is going to go, you know, much lower than it was in December. Mm-hmm. And it's the same for Barrick. You look at Barrick, the price to book value, it's, again, its lowest in 40 years, other than the last quarter of 2015. So you'd have to have a lot go wrong for these companies to go lower than where they were at the end of last year, mm-hmm. in my view.
Adrian, when we think about the activity of mergers and acquisitions between larger companies and smaller companies, you know, the bigger guys trying to replace their ounces in the ground, how does that fit into the mining cycle? And what indications can that give us about where these bigger indices are headed?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because, of course, in 2010, 11, 12, this is probably why you're asking the question, you know, we saw a mass of mergers and acquisitions that did, in fact, indicate a top. They rang the bell at the top. Mm-hmm. We've seen a pickup of mergers and acquisitions, particularly acquisitions, well, mergers and acquisitions in the last, we've seen a pickup in that recently. But I think... with a couple of exceptions, nobody has been scratching their heads at the prices that were paid, which is what you saw back in 2011-12. People were overpaying for marginal assets. So clearly, if there's two or three companies looking for an asset or a company, you know, there's a competition, you have to pay up. But I don't think we're getting the sort of irrational prices that we saw back then. And some companies like Barrick's a good example, are just not doing mergers and acquisitions at the moment. Or they're only doing very, very tiny ones relative to the size of the company. So I think what we're seeing now is a much more rational scenario where companies are catching up from several years of not doing any acquisitions. They're catching up, and a long, long way from where we were, you know, in 2011, in my mind.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that is a good indicator, anecdotal indicator, of when we're at a top in gold, when people are just paying too much for marginal assets. And you look at a lot of the assets that were bought in 2011, not only was something like 75% of all of the money the gold mining company spent in 2011 on acquisitions, 75% of that was written off, not written down, written off within 4 years.
Jeez.
But... And some of those mines are still not in production, you know, 12 years later. Mm-hmm. But that's a good sign if you see that kind of irrational behavior.
And how about how, let's say, exploration expenditure, how does that fit into this cycle as well? You know, it would be a good indication that some of these management teams are wanting to put money back into the ground. And have the money to do so, right?
Sure. They certainly have the money because the cash flows have been very strong. A lot of companies will use the junior companies as their sort of exploration arms, if you like, unofficial exploration arms, rather than have their own exploration teams. Other companies, of course, have their own exploration teams and are very active. Yeah, but the money being spent globally on looking for gold projects has remained relatively high, certainly lower than 2011-12, but that's to be expected. But it's remained high, and it's moved up. You know, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it's moved up, you know, steadily since the lows in 2014. It's moved up steadily. So I think, you know, there's no question that companies are looking, and it's everything. It's brownfields. Some companies, not all, but some companies are doing greenfields. Most of the greenfields is done by the juniors, and then a senior will come in a joint venture if they're interested. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the dollars are being spent. There's no question about that. It's just it's just more and more difficult to find deposits, obviously, because deposits are finite. And, you know, all of the nice, easy places have been looked at. And easy both in geology and also in political risk. But let's not forget, I mean, Anglo has just made that amazing discovery in the last 18 months in southern Nevada, 13.2 million ounces they've discovered in the last 12 months. And so even in a country, even in a jurisdiction like Nevada, that you would have thought had been picked over as much as anything could be picked over, you know, there's still opportunities for big discoveries. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a reason that area wasn't looked at so much in the last few years, because it's where the government, the administration was thinking of putting all the nuclear waste, if you remember. I forget the name of the place, but they were looking at building a nuclear waste facility in southern Nevada. So obviously companies weren't looking around that, but still, the point remains, a 13 million ounce discovery in Nevada tells you that there's still ounces to be discovered. Mm-hmm.
So, Adrian, how do you separate out your portfolio? Do you have any set rules on, you know, let's say the portion of it that contains existing miners versus developers versus explorers? Do you have any set rules around how you structure that?
No, I don't have any set rules. I think a lot of it depends on the part of the cycle we're in and the relative value. So right now, I would say that the best place to put most of your money is in the senior miners and in the major royalty companies. As Rick Rule likes to say, you know, don't eat hamburger when the filet's on sale. And if you look at companies like Agnico and Barrick and Franco and Wheaton and Royal and, you know, they're all excellent companies that are selling at low multiples relative to their own historical multiples. You can be reasonably sure. So not only does are they undervalued relative to their history, but equally when the gold sector really takes off, the money first of all flows into the big caps. It flows into the big cap miners and the big cap royalty companies. So they will be the first to move. They'll also be, and this is important, the more certain to move. So if someone was to buy, you know, did I name five or six stocks? I forget which, but if you were to buy those six stocks now, I can virtually guarantee you, as much as the SEC allows me to guarantee anything, but I can virtually guarantee you that if gold goes to 2,500, those five stocks will all do very, very well. If you buy Consolidated, Moose Pasture, and Amalgamated Ajax, they may or may not do well, even if gold moves up. So you've got stocks that are cheap, you've undervalued, you've got stocks that will be the first to move and the most certain to move. So that's where I'm putting most of the money now. Having said that, some of the juniors and the explorations are just stupidly cheap right now. I prefer to look at companies that either have strong balance sheets. And a strong balance sheet means they have the capital to pursue their program for the next 18 or 24 months. You know, people call it the runway. There's no point in having a lot of cash if it only gets you through the next 3 months. And similarly, you can have a company with very low cash level, but it's enough for them to get through 2 years. Mm-hmm. So a good runway or cash flow, or at the very minimum, access to capital. We all know there's certain companies that even when the markets are really bad, there's certain CEOs, certain companies that can always raise capital. Mm-hmm. And there's others that can't. So you just need to have companies with cash or cash flow or access to capital in this kind of environment. And you know, there's plenty of them.
You mentioned royalty and maybe streaming companies as well there. Do you like those types of plays? And do you think that they've been a net positive for the industry in providing another source of capital for the industry.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm a huge, and when I say royalty, I'm talking about the royalties and streamers. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think they've been a huge positive for the industry. Now, originally, of course, when Franco started, you know, and when the other companies, Royal came along, I think Royal was probably the second one, they were primarily buying existing royalties. And those royalties would typically be the royalty that was given to the landowner, mm-hmm. You know, when the company, legacy royalties given to the landowner. But over the years, as the industry has developed, no, it's been an incredible benefit, I think, in providing capital at different times in the cycle. You know, there'll be times in the cycle where interest rates are high, like now, and times when banks don't want to lend money to mining projects. There'll be times when equity markets are easy and equity markets are more difficult. And there'll be times when, you know, the royalties, the streams become the cheapest source of available capital. Now, any major project now has a bit of equity, a bit of debt, a bit of streaming, but the relative balance of those will be dependent upon just the relative opportunities in the market at any given time. Mm-hmm. So, no, I think it's been a tremendous boon to the industry. I know there are some people, some mining CEOs, you've probably had some on your show, no names, who, you know, swear they will never sell a royalty or a stream on their project. And I, you know, I sort of understand the emotion, but the plain truth is when you're developing a project, you have to have dilution. You either issue equity mm-hmm. at the corporate level, you bring in a partner and dilute at the property level, you issue a stream and give away, you know, sell half your product at a low price. But you have to have dilution to develop a project. And it's just a matter of which is the cheapest and best dilution at any particular time in the cycle. Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like such a, in a lot of ways, a really confusing time. You know, we've had this strong gold price despite all of the negative factors that you mentioned earlier. But I think one that we didn't touch on yet is how low the premiums on physical coins and bars are right now. And why do you think that is, Adrian?
Yeah, well, I think that's just a reflection of what I was saying earlier. Ordinary everyday investors are simply not buying gold at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, gold price has been driven, even this year, it's been driven by central banks, primarily central banks, Chinese buyers. And there's also, you know, in my view, some very big, wealthy, big, wealthy individuals and families that are buying physical gold over the counter. But individuals and small institutions are hardly in the gold market at all. I mean, you look at the gold ETFs, and as you know, even now, but all year, you know, forget last year, but even this year, we've seen more days with net outflows from the gold ETFs than we've seen net inflows. Because of my internet problems, I didn't look at it today and I apologize. But on Friday, I looked at the last 2 weeks. And this was on Friday when gold was at 2,300. So in the last 2 weeks, there were 3 days with inflows and 7 days with outflows from the ETFs. Mm-hmm. And low coin premiums and low shipments of coins from the mints is simply another reflection. People are not lining up to buy gold. If anything, the lines are at pawn shops from people selling their gold. Mm-hmm. There's no lines to buy gold, whether it's gold coins, gold bars, gold ETFs. And that's also true, amazingly, that's true of the gold stocks too. You know, I can't report specifically on what's happening with my fund, but let me put it this way. When I talk to other gold fund managers in the US, everyone has much the same experience. And let's just say there is no flood of people rushing in to gold funds right now. you look at the GDX, the last report, I tried to find a report today, but it's not easy to find. But the last report I have was for April the 20th. And from March the 1st to April the 20th, every single day had outflows from the GDX, which is just astonishing when you think where we are in the cycle, what gold's doing, and so on. But to me, it's just another reflection of the incredibly negative sentiment towards gold. And from a contrarian point of view, you know, gold is so underowned right now. But when we see a turn, it will move very, very dramatically. I mean, again, you only have to look at the, you know, I said there were outflows in the GDX, and that's true. So people must have been buying individual stocks. And I think it was some family offices, some hedge funds were buying individual stocks, but individual investors were still selling the GDX. But you saw, despite that, you saw the GDX go up 30% in 6 weeks. Yeah, that's pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm. And so if we see even a halfway decent change in sentiment, you know, the GDX will double, and, you know, double easily.
Do you think that there is a bit of an overhang in silver around $30 as well? Not just as a psychological level, but, you know, as it being a break-even point for many speculators that came into the space around that level as well?
No question about that. That's a heavy, as you say, sentiment, but also, you know, break even for a lot of people. I'm always amused by people whose investment objective is to get back to break even, which always amuses me. Because why wait, you know, 2 or 3 years just to get back to break even? If you don't like something, get out of it and buy something else. But anyway, that's definitely an overhang. But I think the thing about silver, one of the things about silver is there is not a lot. There's obviously people who hold silver coins and silver ETFs, but there's not a lot of physical silver in terms of, you know, silver plates and silver teapots and all that kind of stuff. I think you wouldn't, because all of that came out, all of the attics were cleared out, right, in 1980. So I think you need gold. I think you need silver to go meaningfully higher before you start getting people lining up at pawn shops with their silver, the way we saw back in 1980.
You know, before we move away from this idea, you mentioned these family offices that might be buying gold over the OTC or over the counter markets. How does that not show up in the price?
Well, it does show up in the price. No, it shows up in the price, but it doesn't show up in like daily or weekly reports.
Okay.
You can go to the World Gold Council and you can look at every central bank that is buying or selling gold. They're delayed. The reports are delayed, sometimes as much as 6 weeks, but the reports are all there. You can go and look at GLD and look every single day at what the inflow or outflow the day before was. So all those reports are there. But if a Saudi royal family decides to buy physical gold over the counter in Switzerland, to my knowledge, there is no report that shows up showing how much was bought and when. Mm-hmm. But it definitely affects the price, no question.
Okay.
Because that gold has to be bought. Yeah. And that's the point I was making. But if you look at the central bank buying, number one buying, no doubt, then you look at China, you look at both the Shanghai Commodities Exchange and you look at the imports of physical into Hong Kong, which is traditionally where gold has moved into China. Combined, those things are overwhelmingly the largest factor in the buying, but they are clearly not all of it, especially when you net out the Western selling through ETFs. And make an assumption on the coin sales, there's someone else in the market that's reasonably big, not as big as the central banks, but reasonably big. I think it is very wealthy families and individuals, primarily in the Middle East, in the Gulf, and also in Asia, but also in the US, and we've seen some people in the US take big positions in gold, but are concerned about the fragility of the financial system. It's not, and again, when you're concerned about the fragility of the system, you're not buying for a 10 or 15% move over the next 3 months. You're relatively price insensitive, and you're buying as a defensive position. You're probably buying for many, 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 many months, if not years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when investors finally get around to buying, I think the prices are going to be higher.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's interesting. You know, we have these countervailing forces where it seems like, you know, we should be paying attention to the smart money, what the central banks and these big institutional investors are doing. And yet it seems like the average investor, the average speculator, the average consumer isn't doing as well. So how does that also translate into how poorly the economy is doing versus what the reported numbers are?
Yeah, interesting points there. First of all, I would take issue. I would you beg the question by calling central bankers smart money. They've done some pretty dumb things over the years. But I understand your point. And certainly when you look at, you know, smart people like Stan Druckenmiller that is publicly buying millions of dollars worth of Barrick, mm-hmm. you know, he's no fool, to put it to British understatement. And we should be paying attention to that. But I think you raised an interesting question or interesting issue. And the issue is just how poorly the economy is doing. And a lot of people simply do not have spare money to go and buy, you know, 2, 3, 4 ounces of gold. And we can see that with my money management. When we start to get clients ask for withdrawals, right? Not redeeming the whole thing, just a withdrawal. And it might be 50,000, or we had one recently, 200,000, because he's worried about the economy. We had another guy who wants 10,000 out of his IRA, but he's already taken his withdrawal, so he's going to have to pay tax on it. In those, and I'm not talking about specific people here, but this kind of thing, when people take out $10,000 from an IRA, you know they need the money. It's not a matter of, you know, wouldn't it be nice if
buying
a
second
one? Yeah. And we've seen a pickup in withdrawals. The last time we saw this big pickup in typically small withdrawals was in 2008-09, and it's a reflection of the economy, it's a reflection of people's need for money.
So Adrian, where do you think the biggest stress in the economic and financial systems lies right now?
Well, it's in debt, no question, because in North America, but also around the world, we had these ultra excessive monetary policies with ultra low interest rates, which encouraged people to borrow money at too low a level. And a lot of that money is now coming due. Now, when you borrow money at ultra low levels, it's not always invested wisely. So you get what the Austrian school called malinvestment. You know, when you're paying 10 or 12% on your money, it's typically for a sensible investment where you've done the work. But when you get offers in the mail, borrow money for 1.5% for 10 years or 5 years, you know, oh, well, let's buy this, let's buy that. Again, exaggerating a little bit, but the excessively easy money meant too much money was borrowed. It was borrowed by households, it was borrowed by corporations, it was borrowed by the government. And we're now getting to that point. I mean, it's a continuum, but 24 and particularly 25 and 26 are going to be when a lot of that low interest loans start to roll over. You're already seeing stress among consumers whose, you know, car loans, maybe they bought a used car that wasn't a very good car, but they bought a used car 5 years ago, low interest rate. They haven't finished paying off the loan yet, but the car's no good. So they have to go out and buy a new car. They have to pay off the loan they've got. They have to buy a new car, and the interest rate on the new car will be a lot higher. Mm-hmm. You look at corporate in America now, you look at corporate debt maturities, 24 is up about 30% on 23, and 25 is actually double what 24 is. And so when the Fed, when interest rates move up aggressively, as they have over the last 2 years, it affects different people, households and corporations, at different times. The company that termed out all of their debt 3 years ago, and they termed it out so they have no debt maturities until 27, and it's all fixed rate, well, the increase in interest rates doesn't really affect them, other than how it affects their customers. But the company that borrowed money, you know, 4 years ago, they borrowed five-year money 4 years ago, they need to roll over that debt this year or next year. It definitely affects them. And so it affects people at different levels. But this higher for longer mantra is going to bring more and more people, households and corporations, into that higher interest rate environment. You know, and this is one of the reasons why the economy has not collapsed, or the economy has not moved into recession as rapidly as some people thought it would. First of all, I always point out to people that if you look at the last 11 recessions in the U.S., the average, the last nine rate hiking cycles in the U.S., and you look at the period of time from the first rate hike to the onset of recession, the average is about 27 months. So we're not even at the average yet. But equally, when you have ultra low interest rates and so much money pushed into the economy over a period of years, you would expect the recession, you know, there's a longer runway, there's a longer cushion. Mm-hmm. And so you would expect it to be longer before the recession comes in. So I think people, I'm going off topic here, but I think when people, including Jenny Yellen, say basically just because we haven't had a recession means we're going to escape one, I think that is totally fallacious, totally fallacious. But the higher for longer means more people start coming into that higher interest rate environment who maybe weren't in it last year or the year before.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting as you mentioned Yellen and this, you know, it seems to be a couple flags against her in the last little while here. And I heard you mention that when rates were low, the U.S. maybe should have issued a lot longer term debt, let's say 100-year bonds at these lower rates, rather than all of this short term debt. So explain to us a little bit about that, and if that is, you know, another black eye for Yellen.
Well, absolutely. And it's not, I mean, this has been going on for several years now under the last two administrations. Mm-hmm. I mean, when rates are very, very low, you should borrow for as long as you can. You have to pay a little bit more, of course. 30-year bonds are always going to be more than one-year bills, and normally. 50 and 100.
Yep.
What?
Normally.
Normally, yep. Yes. Yes, normally. But you pay a little bit more, but you should lock in those low rates when you have the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would argue that if, and no offense to two beautiful countries with beautiful people, but if Italy can do 100-year bonds at 7.5%, and Argentina, for goodness sake, could issue 100-year bonds in U.S. dollars, they've already defaulted on them, but if those two countries can issue 100-year bonds, why on earth couldn't the U.S.? And I would suppose that if Italy, at the time Italy was issuing 100-year bonds at 7.5%, the U.S. could probably have issued 100-year bonds at 4.5% or 5%. Mm-hmm. Now, wouldn't that look pretty darn good right now when we're having to pay 5% on three-month bills? But instead, to save just that little bit of money, they went to the short end of the curve. And we're seeing more of that this year because there's difficulty in selling the 30 years right now. You know, China is up to its gills in U.S. Treasuries and doesn't want any more. despite Yellen's pleading. Russia obviously isn't buying U.S. treasuries. So Japan actually is still buying, but I think that's going to go away as their interest rates move up. They'll still be lower than U.S. rates, but as their rates move up, then a lot of the Japanese money that went offshore will come back onshore and invest in Japanese government bonds. So there's not a lot of what I call real buying of long-term bonds from overseas. The Fed Jerome Powell last week made the biggest announcement that they were cutting their runoff of bonds, the QT. They were cutting it from $60 billion a month to $25 billion a month. And he made a point of saying they're not going to reduce their runoff of mortgage-backed securities, just treasuries. Why do you think that is? I mean, it's because people are not buying treasuries. So they don't want to add long-term treasuries. So they don't want to add any more supply to the market than they have to. So I think at the long-term end of the maturity, rates are just going to have to move up. The market's going to demand it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a huge, huge mistake.
Do you think the possibility is there that shows a lack of confidence and they don't want to spook the market by issuing a 100-year bond?
I think 5 years ago, they could have got away with it. I think that would be a lot more difficult now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, it's not unusual that 30 years is, I don't know if it's the longest that the U.S. has ever issued, but it's certainly the traditional longest in recent memory that the U.S. has issued. But, you know, many countries and corporations have issued longer-term bonds. Austria had 100-year bonds. In England, we actually had what are called perpetuals that had no maturity date. In fact, Britain just about 45 years ago paid off, redeemed the last of the perpetuals that they issued to fund the Napoleonic War. So it's over 200 years ago. But perpetuals, when you issue a perpetual, your interest rates tend to be reasonably low if you issue them at a good point, because you know people know they're going to get that interest rate in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason the U.S. couldn't have issued 100-year bonds 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But I'm not suggesting they do it now.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt at a higher rate.
And no one's asking me either.
Yeah.
Well, you are, but I mean, Yellen's not.
This is a thought exercise, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent, Adrian. Well, I really appreciate this very wide-ranging and comprehensive conversation that we were able to have today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up?
I guess the last point is just to emphasize just how undervalued many of the major gold mining companies are. When you look at the price of gold, when you look at the margins that they're getting, and not to be continually spooked by these headlines, there'll always be something going wrong somewhere. Mm-hmm. But you have to look at the totality, and I think the gold mining companies are very, very undervalued right now.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Of course, if anybody wants more from Adrian, all of his material is available at adrianday.com, both the asset management side as well as the global analytics side, right?
Thank you. Yes.
Perfect. Adrian, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.